Guten Tag, meine Damen und Herren. So I'm here today to talk about the Netflix original series Dark. That's it's not sweeping the nation by any means, or any other nation for that matter. But there's a lot of excitement for it from the people who have watched, and Colin is not one of those people. So instead, I'm joined today by Zach Brooks. And Zach, you needed no encouraging. You were very keen to have any kind of platform to talk about the show.
I wish it appealed to everybody, because this is a show that I have fallen in love with more than like any show that I can remember in recent memory. So wow. Colin should definitely give it another shot.
That's high praise. So we'll get into a lot of the reasons for that. But I assume the people listening already have some idea what it is, or maybe they watch the show and now have even less idea what it's about, which seems to be a common reaction. But for people who maybe are just testing the waters a bit, how would you summarize the show? What would your elevator pitch be if you were trying to tell someone about it?
So when I first heard about this show, it was described to me as the German Stranger Things. And I initially was kind of like, I'm probably not going to check that out because I haven't even finished the American Stranger Things yet. But this is just a crazy sci-fi story about a small town and all of these people in this town and how they're connected through lots of generations. And, you know, if you haven't watched it yet, I don't even want to give anything else away. If you haven't watched it yet and you just happen to be listening, turn off this podcast and go watch it right now, because I can almost guarantee, like, if you like sci-fi, you'll love this show. I think it's so good.
Yeah, I think with a show like this, the things that make it so engaging and so deserving of that kind of critical acclaim are the very things that make it so difficult to explain in any kind of abridged way to people who haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, and if you have seen the show, I mean, once you have seen it, it's like, okay, it's about time travel and time loops and crazy twists and lots of people that are connected in ways that you would have no idea they would have been connected. And it just gets all, I mean, it's a real like time travel rabbit hole, I feel like, or time travel cave, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, you alluded to Stranger Things, which I think is the natural entry point for these discussions. And the laziest thing you can possibly do, the most obvious comparison that you can possibly make, is to say, oh, it's just like a Stranger Things but in German. And already I am sick and tired of those comparisons, but I think it will come up time and time again as we talk about it, because there really is no alternative, as far as I can tell, that in terms of like anchoring people's expectations for it.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of spoiling another show, I would call this lost season five in an entire show,
but not lost season six, hopefully.
No, not Lost Season 6. Although I'm a Lost finale defender. I like the Lost finale.
Well, that's a hot take. I'm not a Lost aficionado, but I'm sure Colin will love to have you back on to berate you for that at some point in the future. But you gave the elevator pitch. I would say you come in thinking, you know, it's like a Nordic noir-style show. You're expecting this very dark and somber tone. It's not going to have the sense of whimsy that Stranger Things has. I mean, it's the whole premise of Stranger Things is there's this very scary just mystery hovering over the characters and the landscape. But the show itself is infused with this lightheartedness that makes it engaging to watch. And it's about kids, so that remove some of those adult aspects from it in a way, whereas Dark is the complete opposite of that. I mean, notionally it is about children. They are some of the main characters in the story, but a lot of it is about just this weird psycho drama between different groups of adults, and that's what makes the show so sinister, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the children grow up to be the adults in the show a lot of times that you're watching and you don't even realize it. So.
Right, that distinction is blurred more than maybe any other show cares to do. Like, one of the rare moments of comedy in the show is Jonah says something like, her husband who's fucking my mom is looking for his son who's my father. And that sums it up pretty neatly, I think.
Yeah, I thought, you know, there were a couple lines like that, but when I started to put together the Mikkel Michael twist, because I think the episode where it's revealed, which I think is episode 5, towards the beginning of that episode, I was messaging one of my friends, Brendan, who had already watched it, Brendan Fitzpatrick, and I was like, I feel like this is what's going on. And then at the end of the episode, he's like, oh yeah, you called that pretty early on, that it was that Michael and Mikkel were the same person. But watching that, I was thinking, oh wow, Jonas is Jonas and his aunt have a romantic relationship going on, much like on another very popular show that's on TV.
What did you make of the pacing of the show, I guess? Because when you have a show like this, which is built around the central mystery, and the entire season is built towards this big reveal at the end, you know, the climax of the show, probably in the finale, is going to be this mystery is unraveled, the curtain drops, and you see what explains everything you've seen the whole time. But to build towards that, you have to construct the show in a very careful and deliberate way. And we've seen shows like this flounder in the past because they just weren't able to do that effectively. So the perfect example for me is Flash Forward, a show which I was a fan of, but was executed before I even got a chance to finish because it just didn't do a good job of engaging people. And part of that was it was the same kind of thing every episode for like 19 episodes or something. You would see part of the mystery, but not in a way that really made it make any sense. And then there would be some new aspect to it in the next episode, but then that would get quickly dropped. And all these threads never really came together in a coherent way. So that's a big challenge that any show like this has to meet. Do you feel that Dark met that challenge ultimately?
Yeah, you know, I think they did a really good job in Dark of doing quite a few things. Number one is giving you answers along the way. So they weren't just, you know, one of the things that people have problems with Lost about is they just kept giving out questions and not answering things. And in Dark, we were getting answers along the way to, oh, this is how these two people are connected, or this is what this means. And it worked really well to keep you going. I mean, I don't normally binge watch shows, and I couldn't stop watching this show because it just kept giving you little morsels to keep you going. And then it drops the big Michael McKell bombshell, which is arguably the biggest twist of the season, pretty much halfway through. It might have been exactly halfway through the show. So that did, you know, that kind of re-energized, if it was going to hit any kind of like mid-season lull, I feel like it re-energized and reframed the way the whole first half of the season you could read that.
Yeah, I think there's a useful distinction to draw between two types of mystery that you have involved in the show. You have the overarching mystery of what's up with all of this time travel, what are Noah's intentions, who even is he, how does time travel actually work, like what are the underlying mechanics of what's going on here. And then you have these specific sub mysteries like who is the stranger, or what is the connection between Michael and the people that we see in what we think is the present day when we're introduced to the show. And that larger mystery, there's not really a way that you can figure it out, so you're left to fit together some of the pieces, and then they can put those remaining ones in place at their own leisure. But with those sub-mysteries, do you feel that the show loses something if you figure those out ahead of time? So if you're able to make that Michael is Mikkel connection, does that ruin something about the suspense of the show, or does it remain engaging nevertheless?
I really don't think so, because there are so many characters, and they're all like so different, so unique, and the show does a great job of balancing the character drama with these mysteries. So it's not just a show like Flash Forward that's just predicated on a mystery or answering questions, or, you know, maybe another example would be something like Heroes. But you also have so many other ties and connections going throughout. I think, you know, my one criticism I did have of the show was almost that there were too many characters, and you have characters in two, maybe three different timelines. And it was almost distracting the first time I watched through the show, where I was like sitting there and not paying attention to what was going on screen, because I'm trying to figure out, wait, is this person's kid? And is this, you know, is this person romantically involved with that person? But then once I finished the whole season, I went back, and I haven't rewatched the full season. I rewatched the first few episodes again. And just having that framework already built out, it does allow you to focus more on some of the artistic things that they do, the mood, the music, and just the way the show is designed. And that also is a really, really strong component of the show.
Yeah, you said that there are so many characters, and there really are so many characters that it is hard to focus at first. And this comparison might seem like a stretch in a lot of ways, but it kind of reminds me of The Genius, where, like, if you come to it for the first time and you have all of these people, it's in a language that you don't understand, so you have to follow the subtitles. You're confused by the entire premise at first, so you have to ease into that. And then also there are all of these things going on. It's easy for the magic of it to get lost beneath that confusion. And I know I personally, when I watched the premiere for the first time, I wasn't sure if I wanted to continue with it. I saw glimmers of things that I knew I would like, but I wasn't sure if it was worth the effort. And it was only after rewatching the premiere and having a better handle on who everyone was and what the initial starting point actually is, that that I was motivated to continue on with the show. And once I'd made it 4 or 5 episodes in, I knew that I wanted to finish. But getting over that initial hurdle was a struggle.
Yeah, and, you know, I actually, after I finished the finale, and I sent you a picture of this earlier, I created like a 2-page flowchart of how everybody's connected and how the different families are all set up through all the different generations. And especially having that as I was rewatching these episodes, because I would still get confused with, wait, which family is this? Who are the Dopplers? Having that flowchart actually really helped. And it's not something I would say anybody should have if they haven't watched through the season, because it does spoil a lot of the surprises. But if you rewatch the show, which I think this show is immensely rewatchable, having a chart, and I've seen TV Guide actually has a really good one on their website as well. Having a chart like this just helps eliminate a lot of those distractions so you can focus on all of the other really interesting things going on in the show, because it is also that you're paying attention to the subtitles too, so you're reading the subtitles and you miss a lot of stuff going on because you're reading subtitles unless you did the dubbing.
Yeah, the official site for Dark on Netflix, I think it's dark.netflix.io, it has this visual spoiler, so you can click on individual characters and locations and objects, and so you can follow it as it unfolds and get the information that you're meant to get, like without spoiling yourself in too much, but also without getting lost, you know, 2 or 3 episodes behind, because you can't follow everything that's going on.
Oh, that's interesting. That would have been helpful, but I'm glad I have my own chart, because it's totally illogical to anybody except myself.
Yeah, I liked your chart, and to me, it reminds me of that It's Always Sunny meme where he's just like gesturing frantically at the board with all of the paper on it. But you literally see that on the show, that you see these photographs of all the characters, and that's meant to be like this visual motif connected to the police work, the detective work that we see, that highlights just how confusing and mysterious all of this is meant to be. So I guess in those terms, it's successful, I suppose.
Yeah, and actually, if you go back, and the first thing I noticed when I started rewatching, in the premiere, they show you characters in their 50s or in the 80s compared to the present time, and they kind of show you some of those connections, but you know, if you're just starting the show fresh, you don't really know that that's what they're showing you. You don't realize that, but they give away a lot of that stuff really early on, because the first shot of the show takes place in the bunker in 2052. And it's got that flow chart that Jonas sees at the end of the finale.
Yeah, so when you have all of those characters and you're meant to track them across 3 separate worlds, essentially, it's very tempting to think, why don't they just trim the fat? There must be some characters in here that we really have no need for. So I'm already confused enough, and the Nielsen family would be doing us all a solid if Magnus just didn't exist, for instance. I'm not quite sure what his function is meant to be.
He has a very punchable face, though. I mean, like, and, you know, I think I also was thinking the same thing, you know, as I was making this chart. I'm like, well, who cares about, like, Charlotte's daughter, Elizabeth? Right. Or, you know, some of these small characters that didn't, like Magnus, although he is connected to Franziska, who's also Charlotte's daughter.
Yeah, who, going into the first few episodes, I thought she was going to be this big character, and she was going to be a central point of the season. And then after the few episodes, she just vanishes, and you never see her again. So it's unclear exactly what her role is meant to be. And I guess one question that ties into that is, if you have a show that's entirely self-contained, the first season ends with that mystery being revealed. If you want the show to have a life after that, there needs to be some kind of continuity. Once the main mystery is resolved, where do you go from there? And most shows that have a several season run, they cope with that by just introducing new locations, new characters, and new storylines, and you can develop those. But with a show like The Dark, you can't just suddenly introduce people and have that, because it disrupts the plot line so much. So if someone randomly turns up in 2019, well, you need to somehow connect their story to 1953 and 1996 and each of the other characters in each of those 3 timelines, and that's so hard to do unless you introduce them early. So we already have confirmation that it's been renewed for a second season. Do we think that maybe these are intentional red herrings that go nowhere in the first season, but maybe these are things which can be picked up later? Are they meant to be like these sleepers which have this longer term purpose?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And, you know, you brought up Magnus earlier. I think Magnus is going to be important. Everybody in the Nielsen family seems like they're really important to this story. So, you know, is Magnus going to grow up to be Noah, or is Magnus going to grow up to be, you know, and then go back in time and be somebody like Burned, who's Helge's father. I mean, I don't want this show to just get like, you know, just like with Survivor and Big Brother, like we get mad when things are super twist heavy. I don't want this show to rely on like, ooh, this person is this person and you didn't know all along. But it wouldn't surprise me if some of these smaller characters who we saw a little bit of, there's more than meets the eye, and we see more with them either in the past or in this new 2052 timeline that you know, we didn't see until the very end of the show.
Well, do you want to call your shot now then? Are there any characters that you think are suddenly going to springboard into relevance in one of those four or five different timelines in a possible season two?
So I think this is not somebody who's in any of the four families, but, and I have his name written down and I can't find it on my flow chart that I was raving so much about, but the other cop who's Charlotte's partner and has the eye patch, there's something with him because he's got an eye patch, and we saw that anybody who was in Noah's chair device in the 80s, that was the time machine, they lost their sight in both eyes. So I have a feeling that with him, we're going to see something where he was in that chair sometime later on, and he, maybe the chair was working more properly, and that's how he only lost one eye.
Okay, I can see that. I have my questions about the prostitute that Peter visits. I mean, in general, I have questions about that whole story
that didn't
arc.
Make a lot of sense.
But I wonder if... I mean, I don't know if there's meant to be like a wider metaphor with transition and time travel or something, or whether that secret or that scandal is somehow going to be relevant in one of those other timelines somehow. I don't know how, obviously, and that's the entire point here is I don't know how, and they get to decide that for us. But that's the kind of thing which makes you wonder after the show is done, and I think that's the intention here, to keep you engaged and have all of these like fan theories on Reddit about how a potential second season could play out.
Yeah, and I actually don't usually go on Reddit very often, but...
A wise choice, if I may say so myself.
Yeah, I just feel like it's a rabbit hole, you know, just like Dark, where you just fall down and then you can't escape. But I did check out the Dark subreddit a little bit, and there are some pretty interesting theories on there. And actually, somebody put a new order after you finish a first season, to rewatch the first season in a different order, and everybody had their own variations of like the machete order. That, you know, I'm definitely gonna finish a second rewatch of this, and I wouldn't be surprised if I rewatch it another time. And I very rarely rewatch anything because there's so many TV shows to watch, but this one just I think so much of the show, like Lost is my favorite TV show, and Back to the Future is my favorite movie, and there's so much Lost and so much Back to the Future in this that this show is just everything I want out of a TV show.
Yeah, if you're designing a TV show, you want people to watch it, and then that's it, you're done with them. And if they choose to watch it again, then that's great. And if they continue being engaged with the show in a way that shows up on your ratings or something, then perfect. But ultimately, your show is meant to be watched exactly once. With a show like this, though, which I think lends itself to that kind of second viewing where you notice all of the foreshadowing and the Easter eggs and so on, do you think they designed with that in mind? Do they design it for maybe more hardcore fans who they know are going to go back and watch it 2, 3, or maybe even more times?
Yeah, I'd be really interested to hear from the producers. I haven't listened to any interviews with them or from Netflix, you know, with what they were hoping for out of this show. But there is so much built into this that makes it rewatchable, and Netflix wants to have this content that's evergreen on there. I mean, they really didn't even promote this when it came out. I think it's just really through word of mouth that a lot of people are finding out about it. And I've told a lot of my friends, and, you know, just on my Netflix account alone, you know, between the different people who have access to it, I think this show's been watched, this whole season's been watched like 5 times or 6 times through. So, and you know, it's keeping people on Netflix. And I think that's, you know, that's a really good move for Netflix to have shows that people want to keep watching, you know, in the long run, that people can go back to this and rewatch it.
Well, I'm sure the cops are already on their way to your house, but in the time we have before they get there, there are obviously a lot of questions that follow on from that. So what do you think they expected people to make of the show? Was it meant to be, oh, German Netflix viewers might take to it, and you know, maybe it does well enough to get renewed for second season. Maybe a few TV critics from the States notice it, but ultimately no one's going to really care. Or did they maybe think it could become this cult hit, which is going to gain this international following?
Yeah, I'm I'm not sure because, you know, I feel like anytime a Netflix show comes out, you know, they bombard me with emails and notifications and you're going to like this, especially based on the other stuff that I've watched on Netflix. You would think that they would have told me about it. And the only reason why I even learned about this show was because Andy Greenwald and Chris Ryan on The Ringer were covering the show. And I was like, oh, I haven't even heard about this. And that was what first got me to check it out. So, you know, I don't know if they just figure that like internet buzz and Reddit and, you know, word of mouth is what's gonna sell this show. I mean, it is kind of a tall order to ask people to not only watch a show with this many characters and this much to chew on and think about, but also watch it with subtitles and, you know, a show that's in German, because this is their first show in German that they've released.
Was it initially released to a German audience and then it was transferred over, or how does that work?
I'm guessing that it was released everywhere. I think I've seen, and I don't know when you first saw it, but I think I saw that it came out in December of 2017. And yeah, I didn't notice it until I started hearing the Ringer guys talk about it. And that was, I think, right at the beginning of the year. So maybe it didn't come out here until January. But, you know, at least from what I've seen online, it was released in December.
Yeah, I heard about it first from Taron Armstrong. I was asking him, I think at the end of our Black Mirror podcast, to give TV recommendations. And he's seen literally everything, so he was able to instantly recall it. But then the only other mention I saw was another TV obsessive that I know complaining to Alan Siepenmore on Twitter that the show wasn't popular enough for him to cover. So, of course, that drew me in. I had to be in on the joke before everyone else, and that's what drew me to it. But it would be fun to see the inside story of the show's progression over time and how that was received, and whether it matched up with how they expected that to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as we get closer to the second season coming out, which I would guess is probably going to, you know, be around the same time at the end of this year, although I hope it's sooner because I can't wait to see what happens. You know, we're going to see the show probably stay steady with people hearing about it and starting to watch it. And I don't think Netflix releases any kind of viewership numbers, but, you know, I bet it's something it's going to be relatively flat, where people keep discovering it and watching it. And then, you know, again, there's the people who are rewatching it. And I know I've told tons of people who I think would love this show about it. And I want more people to watch it because I think it's just such a unique and enjoyable experience watching this story. And it's so well thought through too. I can't imagine writing this. I mean, they must have had a crazy flow chart themselves to figure out just how they were going to write this whole story.
Do you see signs in the show then that it was designed with an international audience in mind? Because the show does not have a lot of humor, but the humor that it does have is very German. And I don't mean that it's quite dry and that a Western audience might not appreciate it. I mean, it is literally in German. So if you don't speak German or you're not culturally dialed in to German culture, then you might not get a lot of what's going on there. So you need to find ways of all of those aspects of the show to make them accessible, I guess. So do you see explicit signs of them doing that? Or is it just we give our audience enough credit that they're not going to either care about that or they might actually pick up on it anyway?
I would think that, you know, if somebody is getting into this show and is going through the, you know, because there is so much legwork required to really enjoy this show, somebody's doing all the legwork, then, you know, they'll find things to enjoy. They'll find ways to enjoy, to find the humor. And I mean, I didn't find much humor watching it. You know, here and there were things, and I'm sure on the rewatch I will. But it does, you know, sitting there trying to read and digest visually what's going on the show, you know, it does have a lot going on. You know, I can't imagine if anybody like had their phone anywhere near them while this show's going on, because if you pick up your phone for just a second, you lose any immersion that you have.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, if you don't speak German, you lose an understanding of what's being said and done, first of all. But yeah, it's a show which you really have to follow at all times. It's not something that you have on in the background while you're doing something else. It does demand your full attention. And a lot of the best shows and a lot of the most deep and layered shows are like that. But equally, the most successful shows are explicitly not like that. They're shows which do have this wide appeal because they don't demand that constant and deep engagement.
Right, exactly. And, you know, at least for my Roku that I was watching it on, it defaults to English dubbing. So I actually had to change the settings. And the way my Roku is set up now, anytime I watch anything on Netflix, if I don't change the settings back, it's default in German with English subtitles. But they do default to having it dubbed over. And I haven't really watched any of it in dubbed in English, I've seen people say it's not as good, and you know, the syncing is all off and all kinds of things. But I would be curious, you know, to hear how other people did watch the show. Did people also flip it to subtitles? I think that's really the best way. I can't imagine, you know, watching this with dubbing. I think it would really make it feel cheap and tough to get through.
People may not realize that we initially recorded this podcast in German, and this is actually the English dubbing of it. And if you still don't understand me, you can turn on the American subtitles, and hopefully that will do the job for you. So my experience with that was mixed, because when I initially watched it, it started in German with the English subtitles, and then for the middle part of the season, I watched with the English dubbing, and it certainly does affect the way that you watch a show, but not in a way that's easy to articulate, really. There is something about that sense of immersion that is lacking when you can tell, not just because it's in English rather than German, but how it's in English rather than German, that it does feel forced in there. And there was one time when the English dubbing, I think, either mispronounced, like the person who was doing the dubbing either mispronounced a word or didn't understand what the phrase was, so they didn't say it properly, and that just instantly takes you out of whatever spell the show has put you in, because it feels so unorganic.
Yeah, well, and so much of the show is the mood that it sets. I mean, we haven't talked too much about that, but the rain, the muted colors, and, you know, especially from an American audience, watching the show with the people speaking in German on the show, I think it just adds another layer to that, that you wouldn't, you know, if this was an American show and this was all in English, it would feel totally different to the American audience than watching something that's in another language. You know, you feel a little bit more disconnected from it, like there's something off. And they do that in a couple different ways. They also do that by making the show only take place 1 year in the future. So it's 2019. So to me, it kept feeling like, oh, this is kind of like futuristic, even though it's only 1 year off, because it, you know, I keep forgetting it's 2018 and not 2017 still.
Yeah, a lot of the characters they're fairly muted. There's no one who really steals the show with their charisma or anything like that. And the mystery itself takes a while to unfold. So you need other aspects of the show to keep people engaged. And part of that is this immersive nature of it, where the soundtrack and the visual setup of the show and just the overall aesthetic in its totality is what you're relying on. And anything that takes away from that threatens to just turn people off from the show entirely, at least in the early stage.
Yeah, and it does make anything bright and colorful pop, and you notice it. So, you know, I wrote down yellow very early on as a key to watching the show, because Jonas's jacket is yellow. Yes. In the opening credits, the actors' names are all in yellow. The school windows trimmed are all in yellow. Hmm. There's just different instances where the barrels are yellow. There's different instances where the color yellow really pops off the screen, because everything is dark gray and black and blue. And so anytime there's color, you know, also the blue room in the 80s, that pops out, and that's super colorful, and it really captures your attention because everything else is so muted.
Yeah, the color scheme for that room makes the whole thing seem even more just strange and alien, and it really adds to the overall effect there. But my point was going to be, in a show that necessarily has to have that muted color palette, that there's really no room for experimentation with that. But you just contradicted me entirely. So yeah, I'm glad that you noticed that example where I didn't, clearly.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, I have noticed a little bit of red too. And you know, going to another show that I love, Breaking Bad, they did so much interesting stuff with color in that show and the color scheme. And that's a lot more colorful than this, but it's the same type of thing where certain colors pop out and you start associating them, you know, with different characters. And I mean, we're meant to notice that Jonas is very important because he's the only one with this bright yellow attire. Everybody else is wearing very neutral colors. So you know, we know Jonas is important throughout.
And in a show which is meant to keep you guessing for some portion of it, they can't explicitly signpost the fact that Jonas is going to be the central character that everything revolves around. So you need these other ways to draw attention to him without highlighting it so obviously. And the use of color is a great way of doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because it doesn't feel like there's one main character. I mean, if you had to say who the main character is, you almost could say Ulrich is the main character. But, you know, Jonas, he's the first one we see when the show we do see Michael, but then we see Jonas very shortly after that when the show opens. And it'll be interesting to see you know, what Jonas's role is moving forward now that he's in that 2052 timeline. You know, is he going to be this like John Connor resistance fighter who then becomes the Stranger and is trying to fix everything? Or does he, you know, does he take a different path than what you would expect?
That's one of those big unanswered questions that the show leaves open at the end of the finale. So my take is that 2052 is not going to be a timeline that we actually see explored in much detail. It's only there as like this vision of a post-apocalyptic future, which is an example of this kind of meddling with time travel gone horribly wrong. And I don't know if this is the end of Jonas or if Jonas will find his way back. But either way, I don't expect his adventures in 2052 or anyone else's for that matter to be a central part of that season. But I could be completely wrong. And there's no, and this is part of the fun of that theorizing, is you can have these lengthy debates back and forth over what the relevance of that is going to be. None of us are really arguing on any sounder basis than the other, but it's fun to like get in that mindset and talk about the show with other big fans of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, I think we're going to get a fourth timeline in the second season, so I think we're going to start seeing this 2052 timeline. And I love that because then we're stretching 99 years. So we're stretching 1953 all the way to 2052, and we're seeing all kinds of different generations. And I think that 2052 timeline gives us a chance to see, you know, like Magnus could be a character, an older Magnus could be a character in that timeline, and in their children. So I think, you know, eventually they have to cut off where these ends go, you know, forward and backward. Otherwise, it's just going to be never ending. But I'm excited to see a fourth timeline in the mix now.
Yeah, there are people saying that female soldier that we see at the very end bears a striking resemblance to either Hannah or Martha. So maybe there's some mix up going on there. But my understanding of that wormhole that leads to that timeline opening is that that means that 2019 is the new pivot now. So that's the center. And then you have 1986 and 2052. And now maybe 1953 is left out in limbo somewhere. But I agree that if you're going to open that fourth timeline, it makes sense narratively to have that entire 100-year span open to travel.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think that it'll be really interesting to see that. I do think you talked about that pivot point, and something I'm hoping to get from rewatching this is just a better understanding of the time travel mechanics, because it was confusing. Kind of, you know, we have these, I would call them like the supernatural characters. So like the Claudia, the Noah, the Stranger, the people who seem like they can move between times pretty effortlessly. But, you know, I think then we also have our regular characters like our Jonas, our Ulrich, and they seem like most of them only travel 33 years. So Jonas, we see him go back to the 80s. And then, you know, of course, we see him go to the future. But Ulrich is the only character that I can recall that we see actually travel a 66-year block. And I was confused why, and this is one of the things I was trying to find on the subreddit. I didn't find a good answer for it. Why was Ulrich able to travel from 2019 all the way back to the 50s? And everybody else only travel those 33-year increments.
Yeah, you have Helga, I guess, but he is one of those supernatural characters, effectively, who his entire point of the show is to be this is to be hopping between all these different timelines. And that's I love that the premise of having this time machine now isn't would you go back in time and kill Hitler, because we're a bit too late for that. 1953 is would you go back in time and kill Helga, and the answer for Ulrich seems to be yes, but he doesn't do it, and that's what leads to this endless loop where we see future Helga come back in time and try to kill his past self in an attempt to break the loop, the same way that Mikkel/Michael ends up doing. But both of those attempts being unsuccessful leads to what the Stranger was referring to, where everything is kind of destined to happen in the same way over and over again. And it takes some like radical act to break out of that loop.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this show, differently than a lot of other time travel movies and shows, it relies on those paradoxes where you have a loop. And, you know, when Ulrich goes back and tries to kill Helge, it was never going to work. I mean, he bashed him with a rock. Like, that character should have been dead, but the timeline kept him alive for whatever reason, because this loop had to continue on. So I don't know if it's possible to break the loop.
See, that's the million-dollar question, right? It's this question of agency. Can anything you do, even if you could go back in time, affect what ends up happening? So did Ulrich fail to kill Helga because he just didn't do his job well enough? Or was it because nothing he could do was going to change it? And actually, the fact that he was going to attempt to do it and come to this near miss was predetermined the whole time. And he is just he's not even an actor. He is just a cog in a system.
Right. Like, this was always going to happen. And, you know, there's Helga has the scar on his ear that you see. And, you know, I'm still trying to figure out if that was there before the episode where Ulrich goes back and bashes him, even in the older versions of Helga, because he definitely has that throughout the show. And that I'm imagining is a result of being bashed with the rock, although it could be a result of that chair device as well.
What do you make of the way that Dark handles time travel in comparison to other shows that have touched on the same theme? Because it's a very common trope and an endlessly deep one. If you're trying to write, if you're trying to come up with a new sci-fi story, time travel is an obvious place to go. But there's so many dangers when you try to create a story in terms of narrative consistency over time and whether your mechanics for time travel actually make sense on their own terms. So how do you think Dark stacks up comparatively, and then just looking at it in isolation, how well do you think it does that?
So I think they do a really good job, because it's hard to poke, at least at this point, it's hard to poke holes in anything that happens, because everything is a paradox anyways. Everything is a loop. So you can't say, well, how did this happen? You know, how did he get out of the room to let himself out? Because it's, you just have to look at it all as a loop that always happened. And, you know, one of my first early on internet deep dives that I went on, I said I was big Back to the Future fan. And I used to go on the old, like, Back to the Future message boards and read people saying, well, how, you know, trying to figure out the time travel mechanics with different things that Marty and Doc did in that series. And, you know, there's different areas where people were able to poke holes, because that movie series is so much about preventing paradoxes, that Marty can't interact with his younger self or his older self. And, you know, with this, we have characters interacting with their ancestors and grandparents, and, you know, nobody's disappearing from photos as a result of it.
Yeah. So we see one version of Helga, as I said, going back to tell the other version of Helga that he has to stop doing what he's doing, and then attempt to interfere with the timeline in the most dramatic way possible by killing a version of himself. That all seems to imply that interference with the passage of time is possible if you're willing to get involved in it. But at the same time, the entire deterministic argument has always been, well, you may think in the moment that you have this level of agency, but you don't. You thinking that you have agency is itself a predetermined act, and everything that seems to follow from your agency is predetermined in the same way, and that nothing you do can actually interfere with that, because it's categorically impossible. You could come up with the most perfect time machine in the world, and it still wouldn't ultimately change what time is and how it works.
Yeah, and I think in that example, you know, just as you were talking about, I was thinking, like, well, wouldn't 1980s Helge have seen the old version of himself crash his car into him and die? And then when he gets older, that older version would say, okay, I'm not going to crash my car into the younger version of myself because it's going to kill me. Except older Helge, we see, has dementia, has memory problems. So maybe he can't remember that that happens, and he's just going by instinct. And if he was fully functioning, he would have maybe been able to not do that. But that's almost the timeline's way of ensuring that this happens, by messing up his memory.
And that's the danger with going too far down this rabbit hole of time travel. Yeah. Because if you set out these clear rules for how everything has to work, then it opens the door for all of these pedants. And there are so many of them out there to come along and say, oh, well, it makes no sense at all that 1980s X did Y instead of doing Z. And they find a way that the, like, if only one character had known to do something differently, the entire timeline could have changed and the crisis would have been averted. So to some extent, you have to leave it intentionally ambiguous as to how this stuff works. But if it's too ambiguous, then the whole premise of the show kind of falls apart. So you need there to be just the right amount of clarity to keep people engaged without causing them to think too closely about what the implications of that are, and forcing every character's internal motivations across three separate timelines to all be consistent with each other.
Yeah, and one of the areas where I feel like the Dark subreddit really got they got hung up and there were a lot of threads about this, was in the finale saying, people were saying, why didn't the stranger just let Jonas out of the room when he sees him? And then some people went on a tangent that there were theories that the stranger is not actually adult Jonas and he just told him that, which I don't buy that. I think that is adult Jonas. I buy that, that is what happened. But it's one of those where the stranger, being a grown up version of Jonas, knows that the only way he could become this grown up version of Jonas was by leaving him in the room so he could go through the wormhole. So, you know, it wouldn't make any sense for him to let him out because that would break the cycle, which would create a paradox because that couldn't have happened.
If that makes sense, which who even knows if it does? Yeah.
No, that, you know, this is like fun stuff. I love talking out this kind of stuff. I love time travel movies and TV shows, just working through how, you know, how different properties handle this, because, you know, like in Lost, for example, there's a lot of time travel late in Lost, and one of the characters tries to change what's going to happen because he sees visions of the future, and every time he tries to change something, it just keeps, you know, fate keeps interfering and making sure that what he tries to change happens. So you know, different shows and movies handle this stuff differently.
Yeah, I feel like that would be a great podcast topic, just for a general discussion of philosophically what are the implications of time travel, and then how do different approaches to it in media handle it, and are they successful in their own terms. I'm not well versed enough in how it's been in all of these different shows to really approach that in my own way, but if anyone is, then please volunteer for that, because I think that would be a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, I do sometimes like think about, does time travel exist, like in our actual world, could time travel exist? And I've always gone back to it can't, because like the world would just end if it ever existed,
right? And I don't think that kind of debate is well suited to podcasting as a medium, because when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, especially for a show like Dark, like I need to have that chart in front of me. I need to have things written down. I need to be able to collect my thoughts and find a way to articulate them without contradicting something I said two sentences ago. And when you're podcasting in the moment and you're coming up with things on the fly, that is so tough to do, as frequent listeners to this show will already have recognized.
Yeah, no, I think this is better served for like a bar argument, where you're not being recorded and you can't be held accountable for anything you say.
And also when you have no idea what you're even saying anymore, because it's three drinks in and yeah, you've lost any sense of what time even is to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe at the next live Rob is a podcast event, we can do this.
Perfect. I'm down. So one thing that you mentioned when talking about the ambience of the show is the soundtrack. And I know one thing that really drew me in was that fantastic but incredibly trippy intro sequence, which is very long. I get the sense that it's longer than most shows have, but you don't care because it's so weird. And the choice of song, it's a Goodbye by Apparat, which first seen on Breaking Bad, used a good effect there. It's so perfect for what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, no, I mean, Breaking Bad is, you know, kind of my 1A with Lost, 1A, 1B favorite shows. So any ties to Breaking Bad makes me excited. But yeah, that opening is fantastic. It's so cool. It sets the mood for the show. As you watch the show more, you start seeing things in the opening that are scenes from the show. You know, Mikkel's hands being wrapped when he's in the past. You see a body being dragged. And at the time, you don't know what those shots are, but you can start identifying them and seeing how different shots in that opening relate. And that it's a kaleidoscope kind of sets the way that you're supposed to think about this show, that it's not moving linearly from 1953 all the way through 2019, but you're seeing it. It's all jumbled up, just like if you look through a kaleidoscope.
Yeah, not something to watch if you have consumed any kind of psychedelic material, to put it that way, because it's really going to mess with your head.
Yeah, this show's already going to – like, when I finished the finale, my brain just felt like mush. I, like, really needed a day and a half just to collect my thoughts and really figure out what the hell happened. So I can't imagine watching this on any kind of substances. Sounds like a terrible idea.
Have we considered that maybe the entire point of time travel is to find a universe in which umbrellas have been invented and take them back to Winden and introduce them to the general populace?
Yeah, it really rains a lot there. And I do, you know, I think that is an interesting question. Do you think Winden is a real place on this show?
So you think it's like it's part of some like dream sequence, or it's a metaphor for something, or what are you going
like
for?
Like a time travel construct. You know, we see that we have potentially this big like interdimensional battle between Noah and, you know, good and evil. And is Winden a fake place? Because you don't see anything really from the outside world. I mean, we hear about Chernobyl, and we get a little bit of, you know, of music from the outside world, but we don't get much from outside of this kind of snow globe. You know, it almost reminds me of, like, is this kind of like the ending of, like, Men in Black, where we pull back and we see that, like, Windham is this world that, you know, these larger characters are, like, playing with or something.
Yeah, it does feel very self-contained. So you have that scene when the two bodies of the children are found in 1953, and I think it's Regina makes a comment, not Regina, but someone else makes a comment about the media coverage, but you never actually see anyone come in from the outside and pick this apart. So it does feel like there's something odd going on where maybe Winden itself is part of some larger experiment that none of the characters in it are really aware of. It's almost like that theory that our existence is just a computer simulation or something. This is the Nick Bostrom theory. And maybe Winden is just an example of that.
Well, and early on in the show, they talk about a glitch in the Matrix and deja vu. And, you know, I think somebody actually, it might have been Magnus, who talks about living in a simulation. So, you know, maybe like I'm trying to think of other comparisons, like a Westworld type thing where it is this self-contained world. And what really made that stick out for me is that everything in Winden is named like the Winden Hotel, Winden School, Winden Hospital. Like nothing has external names, and you know, a school and a hospital probably wouldn't. But
to be fair, that is very German, just to have these like utilitarian minimalist names, like Winden Schule. Well, it's a school in Winden, so yeah, that I guess that makes sense.
Okay, well then, you know, so maybe that's something that's lost in translation for me, but that definitely stuck out, and I was like, wait, we really don't see anything from outside world. We do see, you know, we do see Ulrich's grandparents or grandmother, Agnes, arrive from this outside world, but we don't know anything about where she came from. And, you know, the circumstances of Trante's birth are definitely mysterious as well. So, you know, what is this outside world? Is there an outside world at all?
Speaking of the outside world, let's talk very quickly about the outside world as it pertains to this show, because one common trope that The Dark certainly does make use of is the use of science as this kind of mysterious or possibly sinister thing. So in Stranger Things, which again we're coming back to despite my attempts not to, you see this lab, and that's it's kind of like shut off from the outside world. There's this question about what exactly is going on in there, and that's the venue for a lot of the mysteries in the first season there. And again here, the nuclear power plant is this important location in the town beneath which all of these weird things are going on. And in the context of German TV, for a German audience, that makes a lot of sense, because nuclear power in Germany has been a very controversial issue for a long time. So the anti-nuclear movement has gained much greater traction there, almost than anywhere else in the Western world. And recently, I mean, there have been plans in place for a long time to completely wind down Germany's use of nuclear power, and that was a big issue for Angela Merkel recently too. So that's the kind of thing which, for a German audience, that makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't have the same kind of salience for someone in the States who just discovered it on Netflix, for instance.
Yeah, see, this is why I'm glad you're on this podcast, because you can bring all of this like international politics into this that I did not know at all. You know, I don't know much about the political climate or culture in Germany. So, and in the show, the nuclear power plant is being closed the following year. So they reference that a couple times,
yeah,
that, you know, we're in 2019 and this is the last year the power plant's going to be open. And in 2020, which I would guess that, you know, we're going to see 2020 in the next season. And part of that is going to be this power plant being closed down.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump ahead to 2052, the way that the show did at the end, because I know a lot of people, even if they were fans of the way the show had done things up until that point, they really didn't like that ending. They felt it came out of nowhere. It was kind of cheap, just done for shock value, and it created more questions than it was meant to answer. So were you a fan of how that all unfolded? And do you have faith that they can either wrap that up or go to new places with that next season?
Yeah, I mean, it did feel a little tropey. It actually reminded me of, and I don't know if you've ever watched Captain Planet before.
I haven't, no.
Okay, so you know, might have been a little bit before your time, but Captain Planet was one of my favorite shows growing up, and there is an episode, I don't remember a lot of the episodes, but there is one that ends on a cliffhanger where a character is ends up in the future time. It's probably like now in the past, it's probably not in the future from now, but you know, he's on like the Statue of Liberty and it's covered in water because the world is flooded because of global warming, and it kind of reminded me of that ending where you don't realize that you're in the future until they pull back, because I thought when Jonas is first sent there, we see the bunker and you know, we see, you know, it looks like a war zone, and I thought we might have actually been 33 years before 2053, so I thought maybe we were going to be in 1920. Wasn't until, you know, that you see the technology, you see like the truck come, you know, eventually you realize you're not in the 1920s, but I think they intentionally made it look like it could be either time.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider what the range of possible timelines that they could introduce into the show. Everyone is familiar with the like 80s revival that's going on at the moment, and Stranger Things once again is at the forefront of that. And the 1950s, people have a rough idea, and I think shows like Mad Men have done a good job at this, of like introducing that that image, that stereotype into the collective consciousness of the TV audience. Whereas I don't know that anyone has a good idea of what the 1920s, and specifically the 1920s in Germany, might look like. That seems so foreign that it wouldn't make a good setting, because you want the location for the show to be familiar enough that it registers with people, but also alien enough that it's not just completely mundane and humdrum.
Yeah, and I think it seems like they've really thought through the show. I wouldn't be surprised if they've thought through the entire arc of where this show is going, you know, at least in a broad sense. So, you know, I couldn't see the show just like, oh, at the end of the second season, we jump 33 years ahead, you know, more into the future, 33 years back, you know, and just never ending those bookends. I think they will keep that relatively contained, but adding this new timeline does give us just a new wrinkle into this show, and we get some questions answered. You know, specifically, how does Jonas become the Stranger? Because they're very different. I mean, one of the things about Jonas, it was hard for me to take him seriously, at least early on, because he reminds me so much of Eric Reichenbach, and I just kept seeing Eric Reichenbach when I would see Jonas as a kid.
Yeah, I actually like that ending more than most people did, given that that's the ending for the show. I think if they come back for season two, I don't know how they can really resolve that or even acknowledge that it happened, because like if Jonas has been taken hostage or even killed in the future, how is he can't just like turn up unscathed again in 2019. That has to be wrapped up somehow, but I don't see how they can do it without going on some weird diversion that doesn't actually tie into anything else properly.
I don't know if we're gonna see Jonas as Jonas in 2019. He might be another kid who disappears. Nobody knows where he went. And they did set up some things at the end of the season. I mean, I think we might see Charlotte going back into the 50s to try to find Ehrlich. I do think that from this 2019 point, we're going to continue seeing characters going to different places, and you know, I wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing that these families are even more intertwined than we already knew.
What do you think happens with just the natural process of death within the context of Dark? Because the question of time travel raises the issue of if someone is going to die naturally between these two jumping points in 2035, let's say, then is it really possible to transplant them into the future and then do things they do there? Can those be transferred back, given that in reality, if it even makes sense to call it that, they've been rudely interrupted somewhere in between there?
So do you mean like, because now you're making my head spin a little bit, you don't mean like what if the actor dies, right? You mean like the show, what if a character dies?
Yes, although that is also an interesting but a lot more morbid question.
Well, I mean, you know, as somebody who has experience, not with an actor dying, but has experience podcasting about a Netflix show that loses a main character, because I do House of Cards podcasts on post-show recaps, you know, it is like external factors can always come in and you could lose actors. But, you know, I'm curious what you mean. So you mean like if, say, Charlotte is in is in 2019. And in the year 2020 on the show, her character dies.
Yeah, if she just dies of old age, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we're seeing, you know, before that point, these characters might travel. But once they die, then, you know, that is, you know, I think it's all this predetermined loop. So, you know, if Charlotte dies the next year on the show, then that was the end of Charlotte's story in this world.
So to jump back to something that I said a few minutes ago, and it feels appropriate discussing a show like The Dark to be constantly jumping back and forth, but in this case, it hasn't been carefully planned out. There's no board with all of this. It's just I forgot, so I need to revisit something quickly. I was wondering if in that war zone in 2052, that bunker is meant to represent a nuclear bunker where there's been some, let's say, catastrophic nuclear accident in the vein of Chernobyl, which gets referenced multiple times on the show, one of the only non-Winden events that even acknowledges that there's a world out there. Maybe something like that happens and there are very few survivors, and maybe Jonas's immortality or ability to go through time renders him immune for that in some way, or maybe it's because it's a nuclear bunker and so he's not going to be affected by it. But either way, that's the context for everything that comes after that.
Yeah, and I think that's the same bunker that we see throughout the show. Yeah. Like, that bunker is also the room, the blue room, and we see that, you know, we see that bunker throughout. But I don't necessarily know if, like, in, you know, I don't know how, what would he be, like a 50, 60-year-old Jonas is alive in 2052. The only Jonas that we see that's in 2052 is the one who's been zapped from 2019.
Hmm.
So, you know, and maybe, you know, we do know that he grows up to be the Stranger. So, you know, he's jumping through time quite a bit. But, you know, somebody like Bertos, for example, you know, maybe he just lived from 2019, never time traveled, aged, progressed to 2052. And there's a 60-year-old Bertos that's in 2052. And we might see him. It's funny because, like, we both can just, like, spin our heads around this, and there's so many different ways that they could go with it, and that's why I am glad I usually complain when shows go on too long and too many seasons, but this show, like, there's still a lot of story to tell and a lot of different interactions to uncover and dive into.
Is there, because I could imagine a second season which it might have a storyline that makes sense and we see these characters develop in new ways, but it won't have the same kind of magic that the first season did. And I think this is an issue with any kind of show where you have this mystery that gets discovered or solved, or whatever the central plot point is, can't be drawn upon anymore. So one example that is completely different in most other ways would be The Good Place, which I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, but this is introduced as, like, something is going wrong here. Something is out of place, and we need to figure out what it is and what is going on behind the scenes. You learn that at the end of the first season, and then the second season necessarily has this complete tonal shift. I mean, it's still a comedy show. It's still funny. You still have many of the same characters interacting in the same ways, but a lot of things have to change just because you literally can't just run back the first season anymore. And I worry with Dark that... that you could have the criticism that many people had about Stranger Things season 2, to put another nickel in the swear jar, that it's like, okay, it felt very derivative of the original season, despite seemingly just being a straight continuation of it, because, like, you can't rely on the storyline that defined the show as it was introduced to people, and now you have to go on some strange offshoot of that can't be fully faithful to it.
Yeah, and I think that where I see them going with the second season is kind of expanding out. So kind of like what they did on The Good Place, where, you know, The Good Place was very self-contained in the first season, and then they did shift that focus. Another example I think would be likely Lost season 1 compared to Lost season 2, where Lost season 1, it's, you know, all about the, you know, this group of characters and the hatch, and then in Lost season 2, we get this world expanded out. And I think that's what we're seeing teased out with Noah, with him and Bertos at the end of the season, where he's giving Bertos the book. And, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more about Noah, because we haven't seen anything about him. And there are other plot points that are teased and things that we got nothing about that I think they can start filling things out for. A really good example of that is, you know, we see everybody's parents and how everybody's related, and we see nothing about Charlotte's parents. That is one big blank spot on my chart of characters. And so we don't know anything about her parents. She's a major character on this show, and everybody seems to have these generational connections. There's got to be more to her lineage and her parents.
Yeah, because we hear that H.G. Tannhaus, the mad scientist who's working on the apparatus.
Doc Brown of this show.
Right. We know that he's Charlotte's grandfather, but there's a gap in between there, which is never filled in the show yet. So maybe that is territory that they can move into in season two without having to fundamentally rearrange everything that's gone on before. Let's go back to that just list of characters, because I have the Wikipedia page open here with the cast list split into those four different families. And when it's laid out in that way, it really is striking just how much cross-referencing there is between all these different families and people within those. And it's very tough to balance that, because some of those characters are going to be more important than others. So Jonas's great-great-great-grandmother who lived in 1953 necessarily is going to be less important than Jonas himself in the modern day, or Jonas's immediate family. And you have this extra wrinkle of characters appearing at different points in the timeline. So it's not even like you have your main cast and your secondary cast and then your tertiary cast. You have characters who are only relevant, or maybe especially relevant, in one of those three different timelines and not in the others. So it's incredibly difficult to balance all of that in a way that does justice to all of the main players. So do you feel that there are any characters that maybe got too much attention or too little attention, and where you would have liked to see that redressed a bit?
You know, I think it's really interesting because it is, you know, one episode, you know, we don't see anything about Regina really. And then all of a sudden Regina has like an entire episode that's her episode, almost like an episode of Lost would be. And you know, the only characters who we see like throughout the whole show really is Ulrich and Jonas and Charlotte to an extent. So I think there's lots of characters that we can explore out. And that's a big reason why I'm not worried at all about a second season, because, you know, if they keep balancing this where, you know, one character is big in this episode and Ulrich, they could write out Ulrich out of the show completely. They could say that the police beat him up so bad in the 50s that he's dead. You know, there's lots of different areas where they can explore, and I have a lot of like big question marks and mysteries for characters that I'd like to learn more about and that we didn't see enough of, at least on the first watch. And I'm curious if they'll stick out more on a rewatch.
Yeah, so it stands out to me looking at the Tiedemann family list, for instance. You have some very important characters there. You have Claudia, who is this time-traveling superhero or supervillain, depending on whether you side with Noah or not. You have Aegon, who is this like authoritarian police chief in multiple different timelines. You have Bartosz, who is like this sidekick who ends up taking on this undefined role in the story with Noah later on. And yet you never really get a sense of them collectively as a family. It's presented almost as these individual characters who just happen to be part of the same bloodline. And maybe that's good. Maybe that's a tie that can be made more explicit in season two.
Right. And then, you know, staying with that family, you have Alexander.
Yes. Boris.
Yes, or Boris, you know, depending on which mood he's in. You know, we don't know what who is Boris? Why did he have two passports? I mean, that's a character we have no idea where he came from. And he marries Regina and takes Regina's last name because Aegon is Tiedemann and Bertos is Tiedemann. And generally, I mean, you know, like, you know, generally the last name is passed through the males in the families.
Especially in the 1950s or the 1980s.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, what's going on with him? Who is he? He's got to be way more connected than we know. And he ends up running the nuclear power plant.
Yeah. And then to continue that theme, you look at the Doppler family where you have Helga, who is the reason everything is so fucked up, or one of the big reasons.
Potentially.
You have Doc Brown himself, who is opening up this vortex of different dimensions. And then you have Charlotte, who is one of the few characters who's at the center of the story, going back and forth through time. So you have so many different generations of this family who are crucial to the story. And then you have the kids who just aren't really there for basically all of the show.
Well, and then, you know, there's the daughter, Elizabeth, who I didn't even really remember. And she has her friend, Yasin, who's one of the children who disappears and ends up in the 1950s along with Eric as the two bodies that they find.
Yeah, but you can imagine them writing Elizabeth out of the season and very little would have to change. It's just, oh, another kid got abducted and that's it.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with her because she wasn't really in the second half of the season. And she also is a deaf character. And is there a significance to her being deaf, much like there could be a significance to the guy with the eye patch?
Francesca, just by virtue of her family, must assume a more significant role in the story going forward, because that seems like a big thing to leave hanging there if she doesn't. If she's just, oh, well, I guess Peter and Charlotte must have kids, so let's just write some in there.
Well, and she's romantically involved with Magnus, and we've seen that these, you know, throughout that these high school relationships turn into parents for the next generation. So we have Magnus and Francisca, we have Martha and Bertoz. You know, when we get to this 50s timeline, do we see their kids or do we see older versions of them? And that's why I think it's interesting to see that timeline.
Yeah. Looking over the Nielsen family, I think they are arguably the most well-developed family in terms of both the total amount of screen time and attention, and then how that's distributed between its different members. So Ulrich and Katerina, both very central characters. And then Mikkel's abduction is the thing that kicks the whole story off. And then future, or I guess past future Mikkel's suicide is the plot point that opens the entire series. What do you think Martha's role is going to be in the future, if there is one?
So, you know, Martha, we see, is in a love triangle with, unbeknownst to her nephew. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see her and Bertoz, where they continue. And, you know, we do see these love triangles. We see Ulrich, Katerina, and Hannah were in a love triangle in the 50s. So we see kind of history repeating itself. So does Martha take either the role of one of, you know, of the Ulrich, Katerina, or Hannah in the next generation?
Mm-hmm. And then we finish with the Kahnwald family. Jonas obviously is going to be pivotal here. And then I feel like Hannah's name hasn't come up really at all so far, given just how terrible she is on the show. Like the one thing for as much as we disagree about the different theories and so on, the one thing that unites the entire Dark fan base is absolutely hating Hannah, and justifiably, you would say.
But she's a fascinating character. She's a villain. She's a bad character. But I think she's really interesting. You know, I don't hate her like I've hated other, you know, like where you dislike a character because they're just annoying or they're not a good character. And I don't want to list off all of the, you know, like, oh, I couldn't stand this person. But it's not that I couldn't stand her. It's just that she does some truly despicable things in this show.
That must have larger consequences. Because if it's just a petty relationship drama that she, by virtue of being this apparent sociopath, escalates to an absurd degree, well, that seems like a distraction from the larger narrative, right? I mean, it, insofar as it warps other relationships, it matters. But the show isn't just about that kind of, like, psychosexual drama. There always has to be a larger import to it.
Yeah, but, you know, and I think there will be, but we do see these extramarital affairs in every timeline. You know, we've talked about some of them, but another one that I didn't even really catch until I started rewatching was Trante and Claudia were romantically involved in the 50s. And this was when Trante has a mustache and he's the reporter, and Trante being Ulrich's father. He's involved with Claudia in the past. Mm-hmm. And we also see Helge's mother, Greta. She kind of alludes to the fact that Helge was conceived, I think she says he's conceived from evil or conceived in a bad way. So, you know, are Helge's parents in the show that we see, is that actually his parents, or was he conceived from somebody else?
Yeah, my theory at first was that Greta wasn't actually his mother, and that's why you see this so much resentment from her towards him. So maybe Bernd was having an affair with one of these other family members, or there's, again, so many rabbit holes you can go down. What do you make of this Noah and Claudia dynamic? Because this is maybe the most important thing in the entire show, and yet it's the thing which is the hardest to figure out, and we don't see the threads of it come together until quite late in the season.
Yeah, I think that is going to be, you know, kind of our big picture that we pull back to expand out on this universe, so that season two is not just, oh, let's travel between the 80s and 50s again, and let's see this, you know, let's see this redone. But now we have this larger, you know, I like The Stand. I've never read The Stand, but I understand that it's about like a larger battle between good and evil, and Lost has a lot of that in it towards the end as well. So, you know, is that what we're pointing to? And who is good and who is evil in this? And do we even know who those characters are at this point?
Okay, so I think that exhausts all of the theories and idle speculation that I have, at least for this installment. Is there anything else that you want to get to close us out here?
Oh, yeah, I have a couple other things.
Okay, fire away.
So, as we were talking about families and lineages, the Nielsen family, we have Agnes, who shows up in the 50s, and she talks about how Trante's father was a preacher, but was a bad preacher. And is it just too obvious that Trante's father is going to be Noah?
Oh, I thought that's what everyone already believed. So maybe it is too obvious. I don't know.
Yeah, because I have Noah with a question mark written down on my sheet, but I'm just curious if you know, is that what we're going to see? And, you know, is somebody else going to grow up to be Noah? I think, you know, like making this a huge loop, like what if Noah is Magnus grown up? And so Agnes and her like great, 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 great grandchild conceived Trante in this family as an entire loop.
That would just be even more incestuous and messed up. Yeah,
I don't know how Game of Thrones-y they want to get on this show, but you know, they really could get with a lot. They could get a lot of this incest and show this cycle. A couple other observations that I had as a giant Back to the Future fan: I loved that the timelines that we were watching for most of the show were the 50s, the 80s, and the 20 teens, because that's the three timelines in Back to the Future, if you don't include Back to the Future Part 3.
Which we shouldn't. It never actually existed. It wasn't released. And thankfully, the franchise was ended on a good note with Back to the Future 2.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Back to the Future 3 as part of the trilogy is not bad. On its own, it's a little rough. But I love that trilogy, so I like them all together. And I think that's probably everything I have. The number 33 shows up a lot. You start noticing that on rewatch.
Yeah.
You know, I think Waller is the name of the one-eyed man. I now see that in my notes. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Waller. And the other thing, which is a really cool observation, is that in episode 9, which is the episode, the only episode I think where we see all three timelines represented, we see the 50s, the 80s, and the 2019 timeline. As they tell the story of each timeline, a different tower raises on that machine. That's H.G. Tannenhaus's machine.
Huh.
So I don't know if that, you know, it just seemed like it was a cool way to kind of break that episode up. And I don't know if there's anything else to that, but I just noticed that and I thought it was cool.
Yeah, that's a cute little Easter egg there to end on. So, Zach, if people want to find you, whether it's to chase you down in any one of these different timelines, where can they do that? And how open are you to them reaching out?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I love this show. I want to keep talking about it. Probably the easiest way is find me on Twitter. I'm at BrooksZA. And, you know, I love sci-fi type shows like this. I'm interested in kind of exploring what else is out there. Primer is a really great movie if you like this concept. It's a smaller scale time travel story, but it's one that you can watch a million times and read the Wikipedia article and still not really understand what all happened. So I would check that out if you dig this show. I did hear Josh Wiggler say that he's going to be covering a show called, I think it's called Altered Carbon, and it comes out this weekend on Netflix, actually. And he described it as Blade Runner plus Westworld. So, I mean, those are two awesome sci-fi properties. So that show definitely sounds like it's worth checking out. Oh, and two other really good shows that aren't quite time travel, but sci-fi-y is Leftovers and Westworld. They're both really great.
Yeah, I was never able to really get into The Leftovers. Because I usually watch one or two episodes of a show, and then I can tell pretty quickly if I'm going to be able to stay engaged with it. And with The Leftovers, I wanted to like the premise, but it just didn't hook me in fast enough to keep it going.
Yeah, it's one that it's worth sticking with. I think everybody says, you know, if you get six or seven episodes in, you'll really like it. And the second season turns things up and works really, really well. But it's sad. It's a depressing show. It's not necessarily for everybody.
There is a sense in which shows like this, they get away with not having to write as well, because there's always this this larger question that keeps you tuning in. Whereas for most shows, if you don't like the characters, you don't like the plot points, well, you just tune out and that's that. Whereas you want to know, you want to be in on the joke, you want to find out what the mystery is. And so as long as they can just drop these occasional teasers in, they can go as slow as they like, or they can write as poorly as they like, knowing that that feeling of having a sunk cost is much stronger for a show like that.
Yeah, you got to know what the island is, Dom.
I really don't, Zach. I really don't. But yeah,
that might have been better left on unfinished. But I love Lost. It's still great. I just think people wouldn't have been as mad if they just never got any answers at all.
Yeah, I don't want to know what the island is, and I never want to meet the mother. Is what I've learned.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to meet the mother, because then she's just going to show up in an episode of Black Mirror.
And she'll show up in Winden in, you know, 2085 or whatever the next timeline is, and a whole other loop will start over again.
Yeah, exactly. I did love that I don't know any of the actors in this show. I've never seen any of them in anything else. Maybe that's because I don't watch German TV, but nobody was recognizable to me. So it kept that immersive experience for me, because it's all new people. And they were all, I thought the acting was really good, and the actors they chose for the different timelines all resembled who they were supposed to be playing.
I discussed this when I had Taron on to talk Black Mirror, but the sense that I get, and I'm curious if you have a different take on this than he did, is that American audiences, and maybe this is Western audiences in general, have a very actor-centric view of shows. So the common reaction whenever you're either pitching a show to someone or you hear about it is, oh, such and such was in that show. Whereas, at least for Black Mirror in the UK, that wasn't the case. And maybe that isn't what you have for Dark in Germany either.
Yeah, I hope that we don't see like some random cameo like the How I Met Your Mother show up in season 2 of Dark, and we keep it relatively unknown. But I think Black Mirror especially has shifted from the early episodes of Black Mirror, where all unknown people for the most part. And now it's like, oh, there's that guy from Game of Thrones, or, you know, there's this person from Breaking Bad. Especially this latest season, you started seeing a lot more people that were recognizable.
Yeah, Jesse Plemons as Todd, making a nice reprise in there. But yeah, you have some actors who retrospectively are popular now because they found their footing with Black Mirror, and that's what catapulted them up there. So Daniel Kaluuya, he's the perfect example there.
Yeah, and I loved on your Black Mirror recap that you guys talked about two of my favorite episodes exclusively. 15 Million Merits, I don't think gets enough love. That episode, after I watched that episode of Black Mirror, like, I couldn't go to sleep. I was so disturbed from that episode, and that's what really hooked me.
Well, everyone loves 15 Million Merits. It's the real hipsters love Nosedive. That's where the real magic's at.
Yeah, Nosedive is also great. I'm surprised, but I feel like both of those I see on lists, they're too low. And Nosedive was another one where it just felt that one was so close to being real.
Yeah, absolutely. So on that note, I think we'll get out of here. If you want to be finding me, I'm on Twitter at DomHRV. You can email us, domandcolin@gmail.com, if you have any feedback on this or any of our other episodes, or there are shows that you want us to talk about, then by all means, reach out and let us know. But for now, thank you for listening, and we will see you all next time.